listening to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're on episode number 614. My name is Camden Busey. I'm back here in Grays Lake, Illinois, recording, and I've got a really fun episode for you lined up today. We've been talking a lot of history and theology now for almost 12 years, every week, every Friday, and we have a first today. So we're branching out and speaking about some theological and historical issues within our confessional tradition and beyond, but I've got a wonderful guest. Let me introduce to you today first. We have Dr. Bracy Hill. Bracy is a senior lecturer in history at Baylor University, and he has a PhD from Baylor there, also a BA from Missouri State, and an MA from Notre Dame. I want to hold that against you. I'm a Michigan I'm a Michigan fan myself. Go Wolverines.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. But let me explain why this is so cool. Today we're going to be talking about this book and the topics therein: God, Nimrod, and the World, Exploring Christian Perspectives on Sport Hunting. It was edited by our guest today, Bracy Hill, as well as a colleague of his, John White, and I'm delighted to look into this book published by Mercer University Press. A lot of listeners know I really enjoy hunting. I mean, I'm an adult onset hunter. I married into a hunting family. My father, not a big time hunter, used to do some little bit of wing shooting and stuff, and, you know, shoot gophers and squirrels around the farm, but wasn't anything of a big game hunter, duck hunter, goose hunter, anything like that. So I didn't grow up learning how to hunt from my father, and now I'm kind of bringing him along, and he and my brother are kind of getting into the hunting community through my interest, because I always want people to go with me. But when I married my wife, even before when we started dating and getting engaged, she comes from a long line of mighty hunters, Nimrods in a modern sense, I might say. And they were very warm and welcomed me into the fold. And, you know, the rest, I guess, is history. And I really enjoy it. A couple years ago, I got introduced to a group called Meat Eater. There's the Meat Eater podcast. If people have Netflix, you can find the Meat Eater program on Netflix. But now they've branched out and they have all sorts of things. They have a wonderful program on fishing called Das Boot. You can find on YouTube. And last year, they had a guest on the podcast, none other than our guest today, Bracy Hill, to talk about this book. And as I mentioned to Bracy before we started, I feel like that podcast, you have all the expert hunters, people that are really into conservation and hunting, which is an entire lifestyle. It's much more than just killing for sport. That's a real, not a good way to think about it. It's a real reductionistic way. But the whole culture, not only of conservation and stewardship of the land and the heritage involved, but then also the act of the pursuit and hunting and scouting, and then the processing of the animal and the eating and carrying on that legacy. Everything involved there is cherished a lot at Meat Eater. And so Bracy was able to bring many theological and historical lessons to the hunting community. And I feel as if today we're able to bring some lessons about hunting and creation from a Christian perspective to a theological and historical community. We're kind of doing, in my mind, at least the flip side to what you did on Meat Eater last year. So anyway, it's an enormously long and rambling introduction, but welcome welcome to the program, Bracy. It's really great to have you with us. And you're the first to have some pelts in the background, and you warm my heart.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You bet. And thanks for taking the time today. I know you've got some things going on this afternoon with a big conference. Might you, introduce yourself a little bit to our audience and just to maybe even explain what you got going on this afternoon in honor of your former advisor?
So today is a conference, and tomorrow a conference here that's dedicated to the life, work, and recognition of Dr. David Bevington, professor of history at the University of Stirling in Scotland. And he is perhaps known to many listeners as the guy who defined evangelicalism, which today many times is given a definition as the Bevington Quadrilateral from his book on evangelicals in Britain. His continued work, his histories, you can find his work from InterVarsity Press, Baylor University Press, Oxford. His work on Gladstone is his historical work. But he recently retired, and so the conference is a gathering of some of his former students and many of the evangelical academics, if you will, who kind of lead the field and giving tribute to him by way of their scholarship. And so this afternoon it starts and it'll run through tomorrow. And Dr. Bevington was influential in guiding my dissertation on Presbyterianism and dissent, most importantly, and eventually even rational religion in England in the late 1600s and early 1700s.
That's tremendous. Yeah, we've really been enjoying our conversation even before we got started. And a lot of our listeners would no doubt be interested in your work, especially in this English history, as it overlaps with, and you know, it's the same history when we're talking about the Westminster Standards and where they come from and everything that led up to that.
Right.
You know, the state and the church are so intimately interwoven in those in those eras that it's really important to understand those things well. So there's a lot of lessons there. And we'll probably get into some of those things today, no doubt, as we speak about some of the chapters in this book. But just to provide people a little clue into one of them and let them know what's going on, one of your chapters here deals very specifically with that English history with regard to the reception of Nimrod himself, this figure from the Bible in Genesis 10, who's known, at least I think in the King James Version, as a mighty hunter before the Lord. We have right here in, you know, chapter 4, a hunter, founder, and tyrant, nebulous Nimrod in the early modern age. You know, Bracy, as we just start opening up this book and getting into some of the issues, I wonder if you might be able to provide an overview of the structure of the book and how the book came about. Because when people are thinking about Christianity and then, you know, the first thing they're going to, is not going to be the first thing they're thinking about. And then an entire book devoted to Christianity and hunting might seem to be a stretch, but when you really dig into it, you realize, oh, there's tremendous overlap here with the themes that we deal with in the theological world.
The background story, it actually involves Dr. Bevington. It was, actually I was working on my dissertation and we were strolling across campus. I allude to this in the preface. And I mentioned something about my wife and I hunting. And he, of course, an Englishman who is living in Scotland since the 70s, recoiled. He was this man who I held in such high esteem as an academic and as a Christian fellow. We attended the same church at the time. Recoiled and in a very British fashion goes, "That's just so French."
Right.
which the episode itself didn't, you know, put off our friendship that was just developing, but it did make me think for just a moment that this culture that I'd embraced was not universal, and maybe it was American and maybe it wasn't. And what was really going on with my faith and its interaction with this other aspect of my life, hunting, that I held so dear? And what were the connections, what weren't, and both culturally in regards to faith, et cetera. And so the book developed out of that. I tossed it around as an escape from writing my dissertation. And eventually, by 2007, began to kind of gather up people to participate in it, because I realized that while I could write a monograph on it, the value would not be my opinion, but a multiplicity of opinions.
Yeah.
Because I saw that the issue was going to be far more complex. Mm-hmm. That there are more than a few books out there that essentially are kind of devotional or apologetic in regards to Christianity, faith, and hunting. In most cases, they're either arguing for the validity of hunting and that somehow, in fact, there's some kind of faith lessons that can be learned in it. The other side, of course, is you can see it with Andrew Lindsay and his Oxford group. And that is saying, of course, that hunting is atrocious, terrific, and of course, arguing for animal rights in his sense there. So you have these two extremes. And I realized that any work that addressed the issue needed to have these various perspectives, various voices. They had to reflect a number of different traditions, but broadly Christianity, gender perspectives, and various regions even, although I focused on North America, mostly on a kind of a British and American connection. And Canada, of course, is included in there with my Canadians in the group. And there are several. So anyhow, the project continued. As an aside, I approached publishers and finally found a publisher in 2011 that was interested. I put together a, yet another proposal for them, began to bring on various writers who agreed to the project, and then eventually brought on a co-editor to kind of take the opposing side.
Right.
As while it is an academic text, and I would hope that most readers would read it and wonder exactly where I fit on the scale, anyone who knew me knew exactly where I fit. So to kind of bring on the other side and his contributions in that regard. So the project is divided into two parts. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted was, of course, as a historian, to look at the past, but also then to look at the present. So the first part is what I call descriptive, and that is essays or art essays that look at Christian perspectives regarding hunting and scriptural interpretations, et cetera, of the past up to the present. The middle portion is descriptive in so much as it takes hunters who have an active faith commitment and have them describe the importance of hunting to them and their approach to it, and from various views in various places. And then we move then to the last part, which is prescriptive, which is from the ivory tower.
Yeah.
And most of the people then who are writing in the latter part aren't hunters or don't hunt as much. They're academics, and they're tossing out why you should not hunt, if you do hunt, how you should hunt properly, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to really give a breadth. Now, it's an academic text by an academic publisher, University Press, but I wanted something that would be appealing at various times in the book or various places in the book to a number of different audiences.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think, you know, certainly any of our regulars on this program will be able to pick this up and read and follow along. And there's a breadth of chapters, a lot of different subjects, but and it is academic, but it's not inaccessible. So, you know, people should know that, you know, I'm probably not just going to hand this off to anybody in my church in the pew. But at the same time, I mean, you know, people know what we do on Christ the Center and here at Reform Forum. It's a niche, but, you know, definitely I think this is landing and might be more interesting and applicable to more people than would initially think.
Right.
You know, so it is academic. At the same time, I think a wide range of people would definitely be interested in at least, you know, a third or half of the chapters.
Right. And I think that my hope, of course, is that my expectation is that people pick up the book and they read the chapters that would naturally appeal to their interest.
Sure.
My hope would be then that they read the chapter next to it.
Yeah.
Whatever that happens to be.
Right.
And I try to, as the editor, to pull then themes and encourage writers to work from one chapter to the next. You'll see, for instance, vocabulary introduced in one chapter by one writer, but then the next chapter will end up using it as well. And so it was a manipulation of sorts of kind of what was going on, but yet letting the writers opine or argue as they saw fit. And to that end, and hopefully, again, there's a variety of things to appeal to a variety of audiences.
Sure. No, I must say, you know, well done. The book is excellent. I really appreciate it. And, you know, anything we can do to have more explorations in this field, I think is good. And just even having conversations like this, I think will open things up. There's a lot of issues at stake, and this isn't a hunting podcast. If you want to have interest in hunting and hunting specifics, and you want to learn more about conservation and the things that face us, especially as Americans, I do encourage people to listen to a lot of the programs over at Meat Eater. So they have several. It's not just the Meat Eater program, but there are many. And then there's a whole ecosystem in the hunting community. You can find almost anything you want to listen to. But there are a lot of really important issues that face us, even as American citizens and Canadian citizens and European citizens. That especially in America, though, we have a lot of our hunting out west is done in public lands. And there is a tremendous fight going on, whether or not, you know, people may have heard about things like the Farm Bill or heard about things such as redistribution or, you know, sending the lands back to the states, which traditionally means the states sell them to companies for, you know, whatever purpose, corporate purposes they may have, which has an impact not just on hunters, but just on recreation and also, you know, the wilderness and all sorts of other issues regarding the species that inhabit these places. So the reason I bring that up is that these touch on important issues, ethical issues, but you know, specifically also theological issues regarding human beings' responsibility in the world and our stewardship before God. A man was created in God's image, male and female. He created them. He created them in his image and in his likeness. And he gave us responsibilities, you know. He commanded us to go forth to be fruitful and multiply, and also to take dominion over the creation. But we don't mean that in a way that just do whatever with creation as you will, but to be responsible stewards, what is sometimes known as being a vice regent or vice gerent. We're kind of like supposed to, in an image way, take a godlike responsibility over creation to care for it, provide for it, love it, you know, steward it, cultivate it, all those sorts of things. So we're getting into that territory today, you know, in terms of what human responsibility is before the Lord with regard to creation. But we also get into all sorts of other issues regarding the fall into sin, because then we have human death at least being introduced. There's great debate on whether animal death existed prior to the fall into sin. And even after the fall, then we get into questions of animal death and how we are to treat that, whether hunting itself is a fallen activity and therefore has nothing for it going on in the new heavens and new earth where the lion lays down with the lamb. So why would we be about killing lions and lambs, you know? Right. Anyway, don't want to get ahead of myself, but these are the kinds of issues at stake and the kinds of things that the hunting community really thinks about. It's, you know, I've never found a true Elmer Fudd. Have you, Bracey? Where you know, that stereotype of just this idiot hunter who doesn't know what he's doing. I've typically found within the hunting community most people, and I would say, you know, maybe you find this with the people that go out for gun season just one day. They just get drunk and go hunt. I'm not counting them. But the people that are true hunters with a thoughtfulness about it throughout the year, they're pretty deep thinkers, and they think about these big issues.
Well, one of the things I mean, the title of the book was intended to elicit interest, because who in the world knows who Nimrod is?
Right.
And so the points that you have alluded to, God, Nimrod, and the world, I chose that title, one, because, I don't know, I like the three, despite the fact that I did my dissertation.
It's a great title.
But the idea was to see what's the relationship between humanity and the divine, the creator. Humanity and itself, the Nimrod is, if you get into the chapter, you'll see that it's a complex character who is related to both nature as well as humanity.
Right.
And then, of course, humanity and nature. Mm-hmm. The problem when we discuss hunters is that immediately those who are introspective, the reflective, want to disregard what many times are characterized as slob hunters.
Mm-hmm. And the like I just did.
And so it is difficult to discuss this because what people begin to do is they gravitate toward one or the other. Well, I'm going to talk about hunters who are reflective, who do their activity intentionally. And that's really the audience. But at the same time, I would say that the audience I'm looking for as well are, I hate to say it, but slob hunters who we would many times argue don't really hunt, but to encourage them to become reflective hunters.
Oh, sure. And they're keyed into it too. It's just you know, a certain type of weekend hunter, the gun hunter, for, you know, just popping into a stand on one morning and just blasting off the gun and then going home trying to find something big, that they're still in the orbit and they're thinking, they're spending time in creation, they're spending time quietly waiting, you know, patiently. But there's more to it than that. We would hope that people would grow, and not to be demeaning at all, but definitely, you know, that there's a growth involved. You know, again, I mentioned I was an adult onset hunter, but there are stages you go to, even though I started hunting when I was 24 for deer, at least whitetails. You go through these stages where it's, you want to shoot anything just because you want success. And it's not because you just want to kill something, but you're hunting and you want to achieve, you want to succeed. And then you go through a stage where you start to get, well, I'm only going to hunt big deer, you know, and you go through a trophy stage where you just want to pass up on anything unless you can really achieve something that's worth having. And right. You move through that even to a broader considerations about being a steward of the land, especially if you have the privilege of having access to private lands. You might be very interested in the health of the forest and timber stand improvements and, different plants and things that you might encourage greater wildlife. You might branch out into a whole range of species and you start to think about the whole ecosystem. And then you get to maybe a greater stage where you find more joy in teaching other people about these things and how to be better woodsmen, conservationists, and how to pass this knowledge on to the next generation. These are all natural stages. So I guess we could say, you know, everyone's on a continuum, you would hope, at least people that are interested in right. hunting, and the goal would be to move everyone onto a greater state of maturity.
There are studies that have addressed this. I believe one came out in the 1980s that began to lay the framework for this gradation or progression, if you will, of yeah. hunting behavior. And that is whether one sees it as a maturity or.
Yeah, I'm attaching value judgment here, which I shouldn't do, but.
It's fine. I mean, but there is. The recognition of the stages, I think, is important.
Yeah,
because that then gives value to those who are just joining. Mm-hmm. And behavior that we sometimes might see as unbecoming, we can also see as that of the entry level or that of the initiate.
Right.
It's not uncommon, but then you encourage then that maturity that goes along until mm-hmm. the final stage that was the scholars. You know, begin to attribute is it's the hunter who doesn't hunt at all. Mm. It's the hunter who doesn't need to hunt, but still participates within the hunting community, tells the stories as there is present.
Yeah.
But doesn't need that. They don't need to kill again.
That was my wife's grandfather, really the person who really took me under his wing and introduced me to hunting in this way. That was him. He was on that stage and didn't really actively hunt anymore, but you would never say he wasn't a hunter. And he taught hunting safety classes. He was deeply involved in the stewardship of his own land and improving it, even with government programs, you know, right. and basically planted a forest where only fields had been when he purchased the land. And you could go to these things, see these enormous trees, and you know, many deer have been taken out of these lands, and it was him who put those trees there, you know, and just to see that lifestyle, that just opened my eyes to, wow, this is a really not just talking the talk, but really walking the walk of an entire lifestyle and a life devoted to faithfulness to God in his sense, not just, you know, in terms of what we believe or profess with our mouths, but how we care for what God has provided to us, even in nature.
And this is one, I think, of the critical things that hunting communities need to recognize is that, one, of course, I think we need to be more introspective.
Yeah.
And we need to realize why we're doing what we're doing. I think that's, of course, that should be true for the Christian or for anyone, but particularly for the Christian mm-hmm. at all stages of whatever they're doing. But that as we're looking at a decline in the numbers for various reasons of hunters in America, both really per capita. One of the things we have to recognize is not everyone has to be a hunter to continue or promote the culture. They don't have to buy a hunting license. And
right.
so it's those on the periphery who are either at the end of that maturity stage or yet to enter into it, who potentially can be an adult onset hunter, those who can enjoy the meat and understand, but yet would not participate. All of these people can be part of that community, and for hunting to be perpetuated, we're going to have to keep that whole community together, mm-hmm. see value in each one of those roles, mm-hmm. and not just simply in the man or the woman who goes out, you know, 20 times each season to go hunting. We've got to be a little bit open-minded, mm-hmm. but at the same time, everyone needs to feel they need to be a part of it, and they need to be thinking about what they're doing.
Right. We need to be as thoughtful and intentional.
Right. And as we're Christians, then that view of the world has to be integrated.
Right.
It's got to be integrated. Faith and action have to be integrated.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's speak a bit about the Bible and hunting more specifically. Now, if you pick up the book, you're going to be introduced to a lot of these topics right away. And some people might be able to think of hunting in the Bible and pick up on a few themes just off the top of their head. But why don't you walk us through some of these topics and help us to understand at least, you know, a sketch or an overview where we might find hunters and hunting within the Bible. And that'll help guide our conversation.
Right. So as we look at, let's say, the Hebrew Bible in particular, the hunter or the explicit references to the hunter are not that common. In fact, one might look at the stories that are relevant to the discussion of hunting in the Hebrew Bible, and thus presumably of the basis of Hebrew and Christian theology. You start with creation, you know, the two creation stories that begin then Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
Go through, of course, the story of early human society, early human interaction, the building of cities, of course, then the destruction of humanity or near destruction by way of a flood, kind of new creation by way of Noah with the Noah covenant that results of it. And then one moves, of course, into the story of Abraham and thus the patriarchs. It ends then with Joseph. The story then of hunting within that first book of the Pentateuch is where we find most of our hunters, the explicit hunters, explicitly referenced hunters. Most notably, of course, we've got Esau.
Yeah.
Nimrod, this nebulous character, at least as I argue. and we pretty much run out of hunters real quick. Mm-hmm. There's just not a lot of reference to it. Now, I would argue as a historian, this is not really unexpected as Hebraic theology is being formed in a, not a hunting and gathering society, but in a semi-urban, urban pastoral context. It's being written down in urban environments. If you go into textual criticism, if that argument is being redacted and edited in urban environments, it's not surprising then that the hunter is not the hero. In fact, I don't find too many hunting societies that write their stories down.
Mm.
In most cases, hunting societies tell their stories.
Yeah.
It's those solidified, founded kind of communities that, of course, are based upon sedentary lifestyles, that are based upon domestication of agriculture or vegetation, domestication of animals, that begin to write their stories down. So in the Hebrew Bible, if we begin then with Genesis and move through, one does not encounter too many characters that are explicitly hunters. And so one has to look for clues, a bit like a revisionist, I hate to say, but looking then for the silence or looking for the hints as to where we see some type of guidance in regards to God's relationship to the animal world, our relationship by way of God's direction to the animal world and the natural world, broadly speaking, and how we are to find guidance one way or the other.
Yeah. So, no, that's tremendous.
To start.
It's fascinating to think. I mean, even beyond the Pentateuch, we start to get into the Psalms, no doubt, and we might just read and pass right over, but there are tremendous allusions to hunting and hunting culture. There's a presupposition that the audience will know what they're talking about. Snares, nets, falling into the pit, all of these illustrations, especially where David is talking about his enemies pursuing him. He's using hunting constructs, hunting metaphors to describe how they're after him. And of course, as you mentioned, in the book and in other places, God is depicted as the greatest hunter. He's often categorized and described as one who hunts down. He's the hunter of souls in one way.
One of the in relationship to the question, one of the most intriguing chapters is one written by Kenneth Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Mass is a friend of mine, and I'll tell you also a hunting partner.
Yeah.
But Mass was addresses the question of where does a hunter show up other than these major explicit kind of narratives of again, Esau and Nimrod, although he does address them when we address them kind of elsewhere. But Bass looks particularly at that figurative language, that metaphorical language, the similes that appear throughout the Hebrew Bible, other than in that those Genesis stories. And what he finds is, if one looks closely, exactly what you're talking about, and one finds then, and he begins to break them down in good fashion, even gives great charts, how then we see that the Hebrew people, if they did not hunt, were expected by the authors of the Psalms and of the various books to understand what hunting meant, what it looked like, what it felt like, etc. Mm-hmm. And he categorizes them. He looks, for instance, like metaphors that are used then to describe the hunter catching the prey, the hunter who is caught in his own trap, which is intriguing as well.
Foiled by his own devices.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and what we find throughout the Hebrew scriptures is that the authors assumed, whether they were urban-based or not, that there was at least some kind of contact for hundreds of years in the composition of these texts with hunting culture, that they knew what it meant like and what it meant, what it involved. Now, the thing that the writers of the Hebrew scriptures seem to emphasize the most was the empathy that one was to feel for the animal that was captured, or even the hunter, perhaps, that was captured in the net, in the trap, might have been shot, might have been captured in another fashion, and that they play at this. Now, that's not to say that hunting is seen negatively.
Yeah.
It's just a powerful metaphor that they could elicit, they could use figuratively to elicit, to bring the audience in and elicit a reaction that would move them toward a deeper truth. But you don't use an example that you think the audience won't get. And
for sure,
therefore, the argument is that while we don't see a lot of examples of hunting, what we can find if we look at the next level is that hunting is there, and that we get our descriptions of interactions between humanity and animals, and how even God is the greatest hunter.
Yeah.
God is the one who hunts us.
Mm-hmm.
God is the one who hunts us like a lion. God is the one who uses snares.
Mm-hmm.
And even God accepts the death of animals. Like, for instance, right, the father sees the sparrow that falls. The reason the sparrow fell is because a market hunter captured said sparrow and sold it in the market.
Right.
But God didn't stop the hunter from taking the sparrow. But God saw, just like God saw Nimrod, who was a mighty hunter before Yahweh.
Yeah.
So there's this depth that one has to mine beyond the superficial, I hate to say that, beyond the obvious.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be explored in the Hebrew Bible and even the New Testament.
Yeah, I'd love to dive down deep into Nimrod here in a second. But, you know, the subtitle of the book is Exploring Christian Perspectives on Sport Hunting. And I think it would be prudent for us at least to introduce different forms of hunting, and for you maybe to define or at least distinguish how you are using the term sport hunting in distinction from other potential types of hunting, and then what that might mean for our biblical examination.
Right. So if you, I'll use what I actually wrote, because that'll help us.
That sounds like a good idea.
And that way we can be consistent.
Yeah.
One of the things to look at then is that there are a number of different types of ways of hunting. Obviously, humans have hunted throughout our history with the intent of gathering foodstuffs and surviving. In most cases, of course, today, we don't hunt for the sake of survival. We may hunt for various reasons that are related to survival, that is, for the acquisition of protein, for the acquisition of foodstuffs that would be what we consider to be of a far better quality than we might attain in a market.
But amen to that.
Trying to come up then with a definition that, even if we're looking at a domesticate a population that's, again, giving us the Hebrew scriptures, they're pastoralists, they're domesticators of animals. So even they, when they talk about hunting, are talking about those who go out and gather alternative food sources. Which, by the way, Levitical law, as Bass points out, is fine with. And there's a whole group of animals that Levitical law accepts as good foodstuffs that could only be acquired by way of hunting. So anyhow, so you have to come up with a definition of, if you will, non-survival type hunting that would be applicable to basically anything that we're going to be looking at in our cultures that are giving us, you know, through whom revelation comes. So the definition that I wrote down, and it goes something like this: for the purposes of this book, hunting is the pursuit through static or kinetic means of a wild animal with the intent of killing the animal. That the animal must be pursued implies that the animal is potentially capable of escaping the hunter. That is, it is wild and free, and the hunter's means of killing the animal. That the animal is wild implies that it is not domesticated and that it is naturally disposed to evade humans. This definition of hunting does not assume a specific purpose or use of the dead animal. That the animal is to be eaten would imply predation, that primitive impulse for survival. Now, I'm skipping down a bit. In sport hunting, the pursuit of the animal may be for one or more reasons, and it may or may not result in the death of the animal. Yet sport hunting has the death of an animal as one of its natural ends.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the killing of animals, for instance, the furs behind me, I did not eat the coyotes that are here. There are some antlers somewhere back there, and I did eat those.
I think they did eat one on Meat Eater, and it wasn't too great.
Yeah.
So,
which is on my list of things to do. But
coyotes, so for reference, people, most states have almost zero restrictions on coyote hunting. You can pretty much do anything to a coyote that you want, whenever you want, even at night, even with lights, electronic devices, you name it. So they're the lowest of the low, really, just above, pests and whatnot. Right. But
they're seen as vermin. They're seen as competitors with desirable game animals.
Right.
As they frequently prey on fawns in particular.
But still, you sport hunted those, did not eat them, though.
I did not eat them. Yeah. But here I also see, besides the wildlife management goals that I had, I have a byproduct, though, of the tanned hide. Right. So was it a trophy hunt? No. So what we do see is, we see hunting for food, hunting for harder to define means, like, for instance, the management of other animals, the removal of vermin, or in most cases, one would hope, taking of animals that could be edible, but for the purpose of, let's say, reducing a population to make it healthier. One would eat those, but you could do that. And then, of course, there's the removal of animals for both food and trophy.
Mm-hmm.
But then trophy gets complicated.
Sure.
So the question is, what motivates? And do people who pursue those animals, do we categorize them as hunters? And the answer is yes.
Yeah,
all of them.
Of course.
Yeah.
Sure.
So the pursuit with the intent to kill is hunting, as I define it. That does not mean you do kill, because I know hunters who are just starting out, who I've talked to, particularly young hunters at colleges where I go and sometimes talk. They haven't killed anything yet, but they're still hunters.
Right.
They haven't perhaps been bloodied, if we would say, or blooded, yet the pursuit and what they're doing puts them in a position that, if you want to say the telos of this thing, the end of it is death, but with a different causation and different results that are complementary to that death.
How would you categorize an analogous activity of angling, fishing? So especially there, you have sport fishing, and so frequently is catch and release. It's kind of a form of pursuit and hunting, but there's no intent to kill. And if you're living in within, especially like a bass culture, if you keep it, you would get major shame for eating one, even though I'll eat a bass, you know?
Right. So, I grew up eating bass.
They're tasty.
No one told me that we were supposed to throw them back as a child.
The sparklier the boat, the less you're supposed to keep them.
But I had one professor who was actually a professor who dealt with Native American populations in the Southwest, but who thought a lot about hunting cultures, as he wrote about, particularly the Navajo hunting culture. He once remarked in an interview that he saw fishermen, ironically, not as hunters, but as torturers.
Yeah.
Because they tortured an animal and then released it to be tortured yet again. Now, the debate, and you can find academic articles on both sides of this, do fish feel pain? Do they not feel pain? That's part of it. But anyone who's ever caught a fish knows that the fish does not want to cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
whether it's feeling pain or feeling its liberty being being deprived, it resists. And so catch and release fishing is really interesting. And while I know many times, particularly even our government organizations lump fishermen, hunters, and wildlife enthusiasts or all together to get numbers, there is a distinction in my mind between sport fishing, catch and release, and hunting.
Mm-hmm.
While a catch and release fisherman, whether fishing for trout in a stream or bass in warm water, has the intent of not killing the animal.
Mm-hmm.
It may be an unwelcome result that the animal is so stressed that it unfortunately dies.
Some of them do, but right?
They're trying to avoid it.
Yeah.
That to me is different. Add to that, by the way, the issue of trapping. Mm-hmm. California just outlawed trapping completely. Trapping is intriguing because trapping is, many times I find that hunters, sport hunters, want to differentiate fishermen from them, but they also want to differentiate themselves from trapping, where trapping expects and seeks the death of the animal,
mm-hmm.
but you're not there for, at least many times,
most for the capture, right? You dispatch it, but right.
Yeah, dispatch it. So very different types of things, but all of them interact with wildlife. They should consider the idea of pain, the idea of an ethical usage and an ethical death for the animal. And then, of course, there's the whole question, do you need to be doing it in the first place?
Right.
Today, do we need to? And that's a question that many ethicists would say, it may have been fine then, but we don't need to do it now. What's the value of hunting?
Right.
No. Particularly for the Christian.
Yeah, it's a huge question. And there are a lot of things to think about here, you know, opening a lot of doors for thoughtful consideration. And I hope our listeners will follow up with this and just think about them. You can even write in, and we'd love to interact. I would with these issues. We've even got a little Reformed Outdoorsman Facebook group, and people can follow up with some of these thoughts. But, you know, I want to veer in now and speak more specifically about Nimrod in Genesis 10. There's an enormous amount of historical information to consider. Who would have thought a figure like Nimrod, where if the name hadn't become an insult, I doubt that even that many modern people would even remember who Nimrod was at all. But introduce Nimrod to us a little bit. Maybe you can help walk us through some of the historical reception and I should say historical perceptions of
right.
Nimrod. Even in English history.
Yeah, so Nimrod for most of us is a pejorative.
Right.
I think in today's parlance, it basically implies a rube, someone who is rural, uneducated, has no real guidance in life. They're an idiot or something approaching it. And so we don't really use the term that often. Ever so often I do encounter it in popular culture. But it almost begs now an explanation, unfortunately. But in the past, even into the early 20th century, Nimrod was commonplace, but its meaning changes. So the first time we meet Nimrod is in Genesis chapter 10, in that transition between the flood story and then the Abrahamic epic that
right.
followed. And there's just a brief bit, if you don't mind, I'll read it.
Oh, please, I'd love to. And if people have the book, you can check out page 68, because chapter 4 here is where Bracey gets into the real meat. And again, there's tremendous overlap with people who are interested in English history, particularly people in my confessional tradition. So this is fascinating. So go ahead.
As a British historian, I couldn't help but roll that direction. So
you got it.
So anyhow, it begins, the descendants of Ham, Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. So this is Genesis 10, verse 6 and following. And it goes to the descendants then, and finally it gets to verse 8. It says, Cush became the father of Nimrod. He was the first on earth to become a mighty hunter. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, before Yahweh. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord, which seems repetitive. I'll get back to that. And it says, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, and Akkad, all of them in the land of Shinar. And from that land he went into Assyria and built Nineveh. Rahab, Beth-ir, Kala, and Rezin between Nineveh and Kala, that is the great city, and it goes on.
Right.
So this question is, who's this guy Nimrod? Because that's basically it. But he's so important that apparently the writer says, hey, look, there's a proverbial way of saying this. This guy, you want to, there's Nimrod. And if you ever heard about Nimrod, you know Nimrod's a mighty hunter before Yahweh.
Right.
Which is intriguing. So you get this character who's about whom there's very little in the Hebrew story, but yet who becomes pivotal in Christian interpretations, Christian theology, for literally millennia to come. So what we get here from Nimrod is, in just looking at the Hebraic scriptures, is a character who's a transition character. He provides us with what seems to be a kind of transition between maybe hunting and gathering, and then the building of cities, not just any cities, but the great cities of empire. And then he disappears. But he's so well known enough that there's a proverb about him. He's a great hunter. You know, he's Nimrod.
Mm.
The analogy is, it's like Daniel Boone.
Yeah.
And we don't know Daniel Boone. We may forget who Daniel Boone was. Ask most people, hey, when did Daniel Boone live? They're like, I don't remember. But I know he was important. Something right. about the Appalachian Mountains, and he killed a lot of things, maybe a bear.
Right. And had a lot stolen from him many times.
So you get this character. Right. But what's intriguing is that the Jewish rabbis and commentators come back to Nimrod. And my argument is, because he is such a malleable character, he becomes useful to Jewish thinkers and then to Christian thinkers as they manipulate him.
Mm-hmm.
The irony is, he's a hunter. And how they understand him as a hunter then demonstrates what I would argue is very much their worldview and their agenda.
Sure.
And well, so he is either demonized.
Yes.
Or he is lionized. Depending upon the period.
You know, a thing you point out, you have in previous conversation that I listened to as well as in the book, this notion that hunters in many ways kind of occupy the border or the fringe between civilized society and the wilderness. And, you know, that's bedded deep even within American history, but it goes all the way deep into the biblical history as well. Nimrod, you know, somebody who's identified with these building of empire cities, but yet also a hunter. A hunter, again, is not one who hangs around doing animal husbandry, but who's out in the wild, in the wilderness. So just for, you know, our biblical theological folks, and just think about that. God placed man in the garden and he told man to cultivate, but yet the hunter would be somebody who would be kind of on the edge of that, out hunting in the wild. So that hunting figure always is on that edge.
Always on the edge.
And then we start to see the perception of that hunter, as you're pointing out, is largely driven by kind of how people view both sides of those things there. And then you have the added element of Nimrod being from the line of Ham from Cush, which right. he's on the other side, an accursed side of covenant history. So he's a very complex figure. Trying to understand how to interpret him, we can see how there have been different positions on it throughout the years.
Right. So, I mean, again, the term I use a lot, I think my next book, maybe I'll just name it On the Edge, but is that hunters are always liminal characters. So if we look at the interpretation of him, let's say in Christian tradition, perhaps one of the most important one is that of Augustine.
Yeah.
And Augustine goes and sees in particular, remember when Augustine lives, he's born somewhere
Fourth
around
century.
355, something mm-hmm. like that. And he dies in 430. So he's living just at the end of empire, just as the Roman Empire is crumbling. And
hence his book, you know, on the two kingdoms.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So we've got the city of God, and we've got this question of how do we separate the temporal, the political, which is failing, from the spiritual, which has long been connected now to Rome, et cetera. When we can't have God's kingdom crumbling, God's kingdom has to continue. Where do we find it in regards to the political world? So with these separation of spheres. So Augustine, when he looks at Nimrod, paints him in a very negative fashion. He sees him as a builder of empires, a hunter of men, and he's building a little bit on some Jewish tradition that's there. Essentially, he becomes what we might call a tyrant.
Mm.
And so Augustine, of course, has an influence that almost is, it's exceptional in Christian tradition. And one would argue even in the Reformed tradition. And so Augustine's commentary then goes for generations. Its effects go for generations. By the time we get to the early modern period, and of course the Protestant traditions that are emerging in Europe then during the 16th century, we have new interpretations, but not surprisingly, many of the early reformers turn to Augustine's commentaries for guidance on these fuzzy issues. And we see then this question of, is hunting a viable option?
Mm-hmm.
And many of them perpetuate a relatively negative evaluation of Nimrod as we see nation states begin to expand during this early modern period. So rather than empire building, he's a nation builder.
Mm.
And we move then into the Enlightenment period. Nimrod then, he's not so much a nation builder. He's a guy who tramples human rights. These things that we're beginning to talk about in the late 1600s, early 1700s.
Yeah, you even bring up Luther's views on hunting and as they apply. Martin Bucer, definitely big figures that many of our listeners certainly have read and appreciate. But this isn't as if Nimrod or hunting is just kind of some peripheral issue. I mean, it's definitely not of the same sort as, you know, the issues regarding justification during the Reformation, but people are aware of it and dealing with this. Like, how are Christians to interact with these things? How is society to view these activities of hunting?
So we do have probably the most famous of the Protestant hunters is Luther, who's not really a hunter, but in his time there at Eisenach and Wartburg, goes for a little hunting, and there's this poignant story of him rabbit hunting, and he catches a little rabbit that the dogs are chasing, and he tries to protect it, hides it up his sleeve. He releases it only to see the hounds catch it and tear it apart. And it's not dissimilar then from how we see the Hebrew writers utilize the poignancy of the death of the animal. But Luther really doesn't reflect hunting's bad. Luther looks at it and goes, ah, and this is how the devil seeks us out to destroy us.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, of course, is protected there by Frederick, or at least Frederick's allies. And so he's enjoying the privileges of being amongst the hunting class.
Oh, sure.
So he doesn't necessarily say that it's a bad thing, but for him, it provides an opportunity, another way to utilize the imagination to understand a deeper spiritual truth.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing that we see, for instance, in the Hebrew writers. And so it's during this time period, it's not uncommon to see then hunters, even Nimrod, spiritualized to demonstrate it's the Nimrod, it's Satan who hunts us, but so does Christ. Christ is also a hunter who seeks us out. And so they utilize the hunter for both sides, assuming, again, their audience. Again, this is the rise of cities in Europe, but they still understand hunting culture. They still understand the idea of empathy, the understanding of what takes place, the pursuit, the excitement, and also the one that one understands also what it means to be prey. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, the idea of simile and metaphor is very much at play in the early modern period.
You know, this reminds me, when I'm looking at this history, it reminds me of the comment that Dr. Bebington made to you about that's so French, but also it starts to stoke thoughts in your mind about the aristocracy and their hunting. People take for granted our American approach, which is actually quite unique to the world in terms of having public lands. And people might not know this, but public lands, we have millions and millions of acres of public land. There are millions of acres of public land we can't even get to, because it's surrounded by private lands. Those are other issues to deal with of another day. But if you're an American citizen, and especially if you have public lands in your state, you don't have to even really pay extra to go hunt, hardly at all. You know, pay $20 for a hunting license or whatnot. But you have free access to go to these lands, and all of the game is managed by the state wherein it is. Now, in the European system, if you own the land, in you know, for lack of a better phrase, you own the animals that are on it. So your ownership of that animal might change if the animal crosses a boundary, but you get to operate and manage and deal with, you own it. You could do what you want with it. With, there might be some restrictions and whatnot, but it's a very different idea. Because here, nobody owns the animals. Right. You own the land, but you have to follow, you know, the government's regulations, because in this democratic society, we have agreed that this is a good way to manage things. And I think it's proven to be true, that the health of our species is good. But, you know, when we're talking about the English history, especially, and I'm on page 79 of your book, where you have a title, a heading, Sport Under the Early Stuarts, 1601 to 1649, you talk about the princes and Puritans. Now, hunting at this time, you know, especially once all the land has been claimed, there aren't just necessarily wilderness areas, because it, right. You know, at least the crown certainly has a claim to all of it. And then even in Canada now, if you want to go, there's still what they call crown land. And so that adds a whole host of other layers in terms of hunting becomes an activity of the aristocracy.
Right.
And that changes perspectives. How does Nimrod fit into that when we start to speak about the aristocratic view of hunting and the views of hunting in the early 17th century?
In the early 17th century, what you directly see is that Nimrod is seen as, again, this kind of tyrannical, you see an economic separation.
Yeah.
And one of the things that happens during the interregnum, during the Civil War period, so 1640s, is we see that many of the forests are going to be preyed upon by the people in this moment when there's no longer a restriction of law on them. And many of the animals in the royal forest, or those that belong to the noble families, would also be killed as well, which, by the way, is a bit of a reminder about the importance of conservation and oversight. But Nimrod then becomes, again, a pivotal character. He seems, again, to be more of a tyrant. He's utilized by a number of Puritan types to depict them bad behavior and constraints upon freedom. But it's not that they're necessarily against hunting, but again, most of the Puritan types are coming from urban environments,
right,
universities and the like. And so while they may not weigh heavily on hunting as a bad activity, if you think about it, during the Civil War, again, the 1640s, it's the roundheads and the parliamentarians, the minor gentry, et cetera, versus the cavaliers and the great landowners.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people who have associated hunting with their lifestyle. And so hunting in this sense is seen as being, again, more and more negative, while urban life, you know, business life, being attorneys, et cetera, these are things that would be appropriate for that Puritan life. I think, for instance, perhaps the most famous one, the governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, who is, you know, here we have this hunter who then transfers himself then to America, and he's a hunter. He's a gentleman, although he himself is not supposed to hunt. So, so Puritan theology goes hand in hand. Interpretation of scripture, which, of course, is increasingly important to the Puritans, is going to be, you'll see then that Nimrod will, again, many times be demonized. But John Winthrop hunts. John Winthrop hunts. Yeah. And he hunts illegally. And he knows it. He likes to just go out and shoot birds, which he's not really supposed to be doing, even though he's minor gentry. But he ends up stops doing it, yes, because it's breaking the law. But the greatest thing for Winthrop and Britain, England, is that it's inefficient. And he could be doing better things with his time. And so his argument is, I'm going to stop fouling as a result of that.
Mm.
The irony is, he comes to America. And what we find is that many of the Puritans in America don't hunt, but they're happy to buy wildlife killed by the indigenous peoples.
Yes.
That who were the hunters. So they're facilitating hunters, but they're facilitating those hunters who were on the edge, who belong to the dark forest, to the chaotic nature, while they embrace urban and village and farm life. So aiding and abetting, I guess.
Yeah, it's a thing. It's you know, we're happy to have this and eat this. We just don't want to really think about what it took to get it or where you went. I would say probably most people, you know, that eat meat, they're kind of the same way. They don't even want to know about the market practices and the, you know, the practices. Where'd your chicken come from? How'd you get it?
Right.
You know, or where, you know, you're eating a steak or a hamburger. Most people don't even think about the whole process. That's been important for my wife and I to try to teach our children where their food comes from. And there's a lot of kids in school that just think that, you know, food comes in a package and they can't identify what they're eating with the animal that it came from. It would literally would not be able to say, this is a pig. This is, and that, to me, that's a problem. But you do have those early settlers, you know, seemingly wanting to live on that cultured side, the urban environment, the order and everything. But, you know, as long as one of those hunters comes into our realm and gives us some food, I guess we'll take it. But they didn't want to be directly involved, I suppose.
Well, I mean, Winthrop, as I say here, it's on page 81. He argues that essentially it's an indifferent thing.
I see. I mean,
it's a term that we would throw out in Reformation theology, like adophora. And the idea is that you can use dead animals, and that's a right. Mm-hmm. Dead animals are good. The law restricts certain activities. But recreation is good. But it has to be recreation within a healthy framework, mm-hmm. which for Winthrop, at least in England, was something you probably shouldn't be doing. But what we see then is that they don't mind doing it in America, but of course situations are different, so it's a movable thing. The food movement has been advantageous to hunting. I say that because there's this increasing fear that we have been isolated from where our food comes from.
Yes,
we live in insular environments, and there's a little bit of concern about, of course, what's the future hold, access to water, what's the state of nature, etc. Is GMO bad? Does this large farming practice bring about a kind of negative result on our bodies, least of all our ethics? All these things, I think, have encouraged people, and there's a number of vegetarians who have moved in and become public in their transformation from being vegetarians to what they see as responsible meat eaters. And that responsible meat eating for them does involve taking animals, domesticating them, eating domesticated foodstuffs, but they're taking the responsibility for death. But even then, branching out and going out further in trying to take wild game. So the idea of, rather than eating only imprisoned animals, going out and giving an animal one bad day rather than an entire life behind a fence.
Yeah. And having an ethical kill where there's this as fast and swift and responsible as possible. Is that better for an animal to live its entire life free and doing what it is in a healthy environment and then to be taken on the spot, or to imprison it and, you know, fatten it up through artificial means? And, you know, these are the questions involved.
And all of these then beg reflection, more than just reflection, hopefully a systematic reflection.
Right.
And so, again, this focus on participation in one's own life and the acquisition of foodstuffs as a reaction to increasingly the fact that meat comes in a styrofoam container and a plastic wrap. At best, in most cases, it comes in some kind of cardboard container. You open up, it's already cooked, and it doesn't look like an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the young people in the environment I work are just horrified that animals might be killed, and they're horrified that there are hunters out here who would kill an animal.
Mm-hmm.
More than happy to go to Chick-fil-A, because that's holy, to go to Chick-fil-A and eat chickens, which live in little bitty cages and are transferred from these industrial production areas to kill zones, essentially, and sub-zero weather behind these trucks, or in 120 degree weather with no feathers on them because they've either been picked off or they've blown off by way of the 75 mile an hour moving vehicle. That for them is not part of their world.
Yeah.
It's their pet, it's Bambi, and it's Chick-fil-A.
Right.
And these spheres don't overlap. And so right. those who are encouraging a next generation of hunter are many times trying to say, look, these spheres must interact.
Mm-hmm.
We must create a conversation that bring these spheres together. And if you reject hunting, understand why you do in a right. systematic fashion. And if you can embrace it, understand how you should do it ethically. And if your faith is a component in that, and it, we would argue, of course, it would be,
yes.
then how then does those revelatory documents or mm-hmm. teachings, if you're Roman Catholic, they very well, you've got at least tradition in Scripture, Protestant, presumably Scripture, and of course, commentators who help us along the way, how does that inform? Are you looking?
Right. And that's what I wanted to do this today, and just introduce some of these issues to folks, and so that we could think more thoughtfully, particularly to our audience as Reformed and confessional Christians, to realize that these are issues that are tremendously and immensely practical. I know a lot of people are already out there thinking about and doing these things, but these are not arbitrary decisions in some case. I mean, there's a freedom within our understanding, but I at least want to say there are theological and biblical categories that guide our reflection on these matters. And so we need to be thoughtful, and we need to be wise, and to think about these issues is not just, well, anyway, that's how it is. Well, we're called to be responsible. And so we see there's so much involved. And I would maybe conclude by saying this, and, you know, over the years of hunting, I have gone through these stages that we talked about earlier in progression, but there's something that really changes you. And anyone out there who's even tended their own garden can know this, that if you put all that effort into cultivating a garden and eating the fruits of your labor, there's something really special about that you can't quantify. And if you have the privilege and the desire, and it's not for everybody, but if you have the desire to go hunt and you spend all the time to know the land, maybe even care for the land intended, you have some food plots, you've done some, you know, real intentional, thoughtful things with the forest to encourage particular types of growth. And then you scout, you spend all the time in thoughtful contemplation, and you finally find an animal, you harvest that animal, and you carry it all through the process. So you go on all the way from caring for the land to harvesting an animal, processing that animal, butchering that animal, cooking that animal, eating that animal, and then passing on the history, then the lessons learned and traditions to your children and to others in the community. You know, we've had animals. My wife and I are the only people that have ever touched those from beginning to end. And I'm not saying that's for everybody, but there's it changes you. It really does change you as a person to think about the entire ecosystem, the scope, and the life cycle of humans within this landscape that God has made, and how He has placed us here to interact with it.
I think the thing that, again, separates growing a garden from hunting is what you pointed out, is the participation, but most importantly, the tragedy of death.
Mm-hmm.
As Christians, I mean, there's this promise of resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And how exactly that plays out in the eschaton, depending upon your denomination, your teaching, your tradition, etc. But the reality is death is ever present. It's the thing that hunts us. And we presumably are going to endure it. Hunting brings about the reality of death, particularly in an insular society in developed countries. We don't see death at all.
Right.
And that process of seeing death as being something that is tragic of life that we can't replace. We can't make a white-tailed deer or a squirrel ourselves. Mm-hmm. This is something that is part of a divine plan and some process. It's come to be in our presence. We've sought it out. We've taken its life. But then to also see in an almost sacramental fashion, then how that life gives life to life.
Mm-hmm.
But in between is death.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I believe, or can be both a rewarding, triumphant, tragic emotional experience that can reinforce our own Christian faith, in so much as we recognize the imminence of death. It's here, and also it's over us, and we're going to have to deal with it, but that we have hope and faith for the future. And it takes death it takes death seriously.
Yeah, absolutely seriously.
The idea that death gives way to life. And we tell our stories, and mm-hmm. the stories themselves are sacramental, and they give opportunity for a reflection that tragedy, only tragedy, can bring to us. And that's what the Hebrew writers understood. Mm. It's what Shakespeare understands. Tragedy does something, as did the Greek play writers. In the death, responsibility for the death of an animal, if one were to take, and I'll just throw this out there, if one were to take the life of a human, presumably we don't consume humans, it's not the same thing as taking the life of an animal, because
not at all.
What motivates one to take the life of a human, there's not that giving of life on the other side, if that makes sense. There may be the defending of life, but the animal as a life gives life to us if we consume it. And I think that's our responsibility. Pretty fantastic. And it makes us feel a part of God's creation, demands that we find our place then within creation mm-hmm. in that poignant moment.
Yeah.
We're responsible for the taking of a life of another.
Yeah, we absolutely are. And of course, you know, difference between animal life and human life, but that doesn't at all mean that animal life is insignificant or that we don't need to care about it. It's tremendously significant and important. There's maybe one thing to just to mention and conclude that one thing that's difficult for environmentalists and other animal rights people to comprehend is how hunters can say that they care for the animals so much, but yet will kill them. And one thing that's often brought up is this notion of what's our perspective. And in one sense, you know, I don't know if this will hold true in every scenario, but it's frequently said that the hunting and conservation community so often cares for the whole, the population. And environmentalists or animal rights activists often, not always, but they tend to have a very focus on an individual animal. So you zoom in on one animal that dies, and that can be seen as an injustice. But for the hunting community, there often is a more holistic understanding of an entire animal population, of an entire species and an ecosystem, and how the harvesting of specific animals within that population can lead to a healthier ecosystem and group. So these are issues far afield, but these are the kinds of things that ought to be before us as those made in God's image, called to be faithful, responsible stewards of our environment, of the creation. Absolutely. Bracy, it's been a tremendous time talking to you today. I could talk to you for days and hours. Maybe we'll have another opportunity down the road to follow up, but I don't want to keep you all day, and I know you've got a conference to go to, but I want to take the opportunity to say thank you, and we really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time today.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a joy. Well, I do encourage people to check us out online, but before you do that, you know, get the book, God, Nimrod, and the World, Exploring Christian Perspectives on Sport Hunting by Mercer University Press. We'll have links to that in the episode description. Of course, you can find out information about Dr. Hill at Baylor. I believe baylor.edu, if I'm not mistaken. And you can do a search there. And I'll also have a link to the Meat Eater podcast episode. I think it was episode 119 from June 2018, but I'll pop a link into the episode description there as well. Again, take a look. Our guest today, Bracy Hill, thanks so much for joining us. And visit us online, reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs as well as events and other things we've got going on. So thanks so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.